exactly whose fault all this was. "What'll I do with all this?" I heard Cusack's tinny voice say.
"I'm going to bring it to Shaw," Malone said, "when I come in. See what he has to say. I mean, we have to interview Daniel either way. Even if he's not the guy, he spent hours surveying the canal. He's bound to have something useful for us. Any update on Amy Boylan?"
"Nothing yet, no. Shouldn't you be on your way in already? It's nearly 2:30.
Malone raised his eyebrows at me.
I mouthed, "Go."
He squeezed my hand again and told Cusack he was on his way.
Allison, then. Lauren's death felt both strange and personal. On the one hand, we'd known her. Not very well, but we had. We felt grief. Not really the "I miss her" kind, but the "this is so tragic" kind. We were all sad, but poor Claire was bereft. She and Lauren had grown close over the term. But on the other hand, she'd been murdered. That was the bit we couldn't process, the thing we couldn't understand. That felt outside of us, other, made up even. How could someone we know have been murdered? That kind of thing only happened on TV. For days we just wandered around aimlessly, listlessly, asking each other that question. Everything else stopped. Classes passed in a blur. I didn't go to half of them. We didn't go out. Liz, Will, and I hung out in either my or Liz's apartment, or sometimes in a subdued student bar, and traded information we'd gleaned from the news, or from another student, or from a friend of a friend whose uncle was a guard. The college arranged buses for anyone wanting to attend Lauren's funeral in Galway City. We went. There were free counselling sessions at the student centre for anyone who had been affected by Lauren's death. We didn't go to those. The Gardaí had interviewed Claire, but no one else we knew. The rest of us hadn't been back in St. John's yet. Lauren had only returned the morning of her murder, coming back a few days early because she'd been able to get a lift off a friend of hers who was driving to Dublin. Information was scant, but it seemed like she'd been walking home alone, alongside the canal, and someone had pushed her in. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, Lauren went from the top of the hour headline to halfway through the news, to an update about the investigation, maybe, in the Sunday papers. The noise levels in the student bar gradually returned to normal, with boisterous laughter and loud music filling the space again. We started going out again, hitting the clubs in Harcourt Street, crossing the Lewis tracks to go back towards the canal, to come back home. Lauren stayed in the past, and her death took on an implausibility. After a while, we wondered, had she ever really been here at all? Then they found Rachel Folan. She'd been missing for 2 days. I'd never met her, didn't recognize her when I saw her face on the front page. Even though she'd lived in halls, it was a big complex, and she'd studied a science subject that was taught on the far side of campus to where all my classes were. The Gardaí quickly downplayed any connection between her and Lauren, but we all thought that was just not to start a panic. We all thought, someone is out there doing this. And we were right. Less than 2 weeks later, the body of Carolyn Brady was pulled out of the canal. That made 3. 3 in 3 months. All hell broke loose then. "I don't believe this," I said. "Look how busy this place is."
We were in the 1A, the biggest lecture theatre on campus. It could hold upwards of 500 students, but right now, there wasn't a seat to be had. After I pointed this out, Liz, Will, and I shuffled along behind the top row of chairs, weaving around the throng already gathered there, and sat down in the last remaining space on the far steps. There was no noise in the hall other than student voices, but that alone was a soundtrack playing at a deafening level. The melody suggested fear, but pulsing underneath, although no one would ever admit it, was a beat of excitement. Meetings like these were being held across campus, information meetings they were calling them innocuously, but we all knew what they were about. I even knew the running order. A briefing from a couple of Gardaí on personal safety, an assurance from them that they'd flooded the campus with officers in plain clothes, a plea not to panic, an appeal for information, a presentation from the Students' Union Welfare Officer on a new service the SU was providing, free shuttle buses from Stephen's Green at midnight every night. Finally, the college president would get up on stage and deliver the bad news. They were instigating a curfew. If you lived in halls, you had to be back in them by 1 a.m. Nothing would be said about what might happen if you weren't. But of course, one thing in particular was implied. You could die. The meeting would end with some information about a candlelight vigil that was going to be held on Front Lawn, and a reminder that if we needed to talk to somebody, there were resources available to us. I wasn't scared. I was sad for the girls and their families, yes, but I wasn't scared. They had all been walking home alone, by the canal, in the early hours of the morning, and I wasn't going to do that. I assumed they all had some kind of connection to whatever psycho was doing this. I was sure I didn't have any. I knew some girls who had cut or dyed their hair, because all the girls who had died had lots of it and were blonde. But if they thought that was how the killer was picking his victims, he had about 2/3 of the student female body to choose from. If there was a threat, if there was going to be more, then it felt distant to me, separate. But Liz was starting to freak out. I thought it was melodrama at first. She wouldn't have been the first person on campus to relish being so close to the action. She wouldn't even have been the 1,000th. She'd taken to sleeping in my bed when I stayed at Will's, because she didn't trust her weird roommate to keep their front door locked. If I didn't stay with Will, Liz slept on our couch. She was sitting next to me now, perched on the edge of a carpeted step, knees drawn up to her chin and arms wrapped tightly around her legs. Will was on my other side. I was leaning against him. The meeting unfolded exactly as I'd heard it would. Afterwards, the two uniformed guardie remained on stage with the president, talking, and a number of students headed toward them instead of the lecture theatre's doors. We'd stood up and started towards the doors when Liz gripped my arm. "I think I should go up there," she said, nodding at the stage. "I think maybe I should talk to them." "To who?" I asked. "The guardie?"
"Yeah."
"About what?" Liz's hand was still on my arm, squeezing. "I think I might know something." This was the first I was hearing of this. Will had moved in behind her. He rolled his eyes at me. "There's this guy," Liz went on. "I keep seeing him everywhere. I think he's following me. Maybe. You've met him, actually. He was in Essence a while back. We were talking to him. I think he was even in a picture with us. And he was at the traffic light ball. The red-haired guy. Didn't he say his name was Dave or something? Derek, maybe. It was something with D." I didn't remember his name. I could barely picture him. There was another memory of that night that was so vivid, I didn't have room left for storing anything else. "Liz," I said, "hang on a second. You can't just go around accusing people of things like..." "I'm not accusing him of anything," she hissed. "I just think he's weird. And they said all information, even if we think it's trivial, even if we think it's not related, they want everything we have." "Liz, I stopped, not knowing what to say to her, and looked to Will for help.
"What did this guy do?" he asked Liz.
"Exactly."
"I think he's following me," she said.
Will raised an eyebrow.
"Why?"
"Because I always see him around."
"Where?"
"Around here."
"On campus?"
She nodded. "Yeah."
"Liz," Will said, exasperated. "Of course you do. He probably goes here."
"No, no," she said. "It's not like that." She let go of me and took a step down the stairs. "I'll tell them. They'll understand." Will was supposed to have a class afterwards, but skipped it, and he and I went back to his room. "This is awful," I said. We were lying on his bed. The rooms at Halls were so small, there was really nowhere else two people in it could be.
"Do you think there'll be more?"
"I hope not," Will said. "But yeah, probably, unless they catch him."
"What about what Liz said?"
A beat passed.
"She's your friend."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning I don't want to say bad things about her."
I made the sign of the cross with my hand. "I grant you a pass."
"Well..."
Will sighed. His hand was on my back, and he slipped it now, up under my t-shirt, and started gently, absent-mindedly, rubbing the small of the back.
Look, I think some people are getting off on this. They're excited by it. They love that there's this major news story going on right on their doorstep, and they think it's thrilling to have, you know, the Gardaí around and all that. And I actually think that's probably not that unusual a reaction. I mean, that's why cars slow down when they're passing a traffic accident, right? Or why people watch true crime documentaries, or read books about Ted Bundy. This stuff is, in a weird way, exciting, right? You think that's what Liz is? I said. Excited. I think she wants more drama. She wants to think she has more of a direct connection to this. That guy, that night at the ball, he was a slip of a thing. A strong breeze would have blown him over. He's not out there killing anyone. His worst crime is, maybe, having a bit of a crush on Liz. She's just completely overreacting.
He sighed again, then leaned over to kiss me on the forehead.
You and her are so different. I really don't see how you guys are friends.
You don't like her, do you?
No,
Will said after a while. Later, when I went back to my apartment, Claire was in the kitchen. In whispered tones, she told me that Liz had knocked on the door, crying, and was now curled up in my bed.
What was wrong with her?
Claire shrugged.
She wouldn't tell me. All she'd say was that she had to talk to you.
I assumed that her talk with the Gardaí hadn't gone well. I thought maybe they'd dismissed her out of hand, or maybe even admonished her for wasting their time. I wondered what Claire, having lost a friend to this faceless killer, thought of Liz and her dramatics. When I went into the room and sat on the edge of the bed, she turned over and said,
"Why do you always choose him over me?"
Her eyes were puffy and red, and in the silence after her question, she sniffed. I didn't know where this was going.
What's that supposed to mean?
She lay back down and pulled a cushion into her chest. Sulkily, she said,
"You know what it means. He's my boyfriend, Liz. I want to spend time with him."
"I'm not talking about time."
"Then what are you talking about?"
"You believe him over me."
Now I was confused. I waited for her to enlighten me.
"He says that guy isn't following me, so you agree."
"Liz, I thought that before he said it."
"Oh yeah, right."
I sighed. "What's going on?" She didn't answer. She started crying again.
"Liz, come on. Talk to me."
Muffled because she said it into the cushion.
"There's no point."
"Why not?"
"Because you don't get it."
"Get what?"
"You don't see what's going on."
"Tell me then."
"I shouldn't have to. You should know. You should realize."
I rolled my eyes. I was tired, physically tired, because to be on campus now was emotionally draining. Emotionally tired, because it had been a long few months with Liz. And I was also tired of taking the bait. I was tired of playing her game. I was tired of acting like her crazy moods, her toddler tantrums, were normal behavior. I had had it. I was done. "Look, Liz," I said, standing up. "I don't have time for this fucking juvenile shit, okay? If you want to talk to me, talk to me. Otherwise, please just fuck off." I walked out of the room without waiting to hear any response, slamming the door behind me, shaking from the anger of my own words, and surprised by them. Allison, now. I went back to sleep for a while. By the time I woke up for a second time, the light coming in through the balcony doors had changed. Immediately I reached for my phone. There was no update from Malone, but there was a text message I'd missed earlier from my mother, asking where I was staying tonight and what my plans for the rest of the week were.
"Your father wants to see you. Come and stay here. The paparazzi are gone now."
"Paparazzi?"
I replied, saying I'd think about it. I couldn't make any decisions until I knew how all this was going to pan out. Something fluttered in my stomach at the idea that I might stay here again tonight. I tried watching some TV but couldn't focus. I found myself reliving that feeling that had passed between Malone and I, basking in it, replaying it over and over in my mind as if, on repeated viewings, I might find something new in that 2, 3 seconds, thinking that I might just get through all this if I had someone who, every so often, made me feel a moment like that. And then wondering if he had felt anything at all, other than a friendly consolation. And then feeling guilty that I was thinking this while Will's life, or at least how he'd spend the rest of it, hung in the balance. While Amy was out there somewhere waiting to be found. While Daniel was in a room being accused of something he probably didn't do. I walked around the apartment, opening doors, peering into cupboards and wardrobes. I discovered a washer-dryer hidden in a closet next to the bathroom, and decided to wash the few items of clothes I had with me. I rinsed out the cafetiere and mugs we'd used this morning, and found the bag of croissants Malone had gone out and got still sitting on the counter, untouched. I had one with a fresh cup of coffee. By then it was approaching 7 o'clock, and the sun was slipping down behind the mountains. I wrapped up in my scarf and jacket, and took a second cup of coffee out onto the balcony, and sat there watching the sky until full darkness came. In the distance, the mountain range was no longer visible. It had merged with the black sky. The only clues that it was there at all was the absence of stars in its silhouette and a single red flashing light that flickered atop one of its peaks. There must be a mobile phone mast or something up there. After a while, I realized why it felt so dark out there, even though it wasn't that late in the day. No street lights. They were there, I noticed, but they weren't turned on. Only a few yellow windows burned elsewhere in the estate. While I was on the balcony, 2 cars pulled into the spaces down below, 30 minutes apart, and that was it. A few minutes later, the shrill of Malone's buzzer cut through the air, making me jump. This was followed by quieter versions of it, a cascade of them, as if whoever was trying to get in had pressed each buzzer downstairs indiscriminately in turn. Then they stopped abruptly. Someone had let them in. There was no one around, no one walking a dog or getting a run in, probably because it was simply too dark to be safe. Across the way, the empty windows of the unfinished houses gaped like toothless mouths. I started to shiver. The temperature was dropping fast. I put my hands in my jacket pockets and felt something crumpled up in one of them. The note the neighbor had given us with the phone number on it. It was a plain piece of white paper, perfectly square, like a sheet from a memo block. Angling it to catch the light spilling out onto the balcony from the living room, I studied the writing to see if a mistake had been made anywhere. If the neighbor had just taken down the wrong number. There was none that I could see. I did, however, see something else, an impression in the paper. I went back inside and examined it under the ceiling light. Numbers were carved into the paper, like someone had pressed down hard while handwriting them on the sheet that had been on top of the one I held in my hand. If it was from a memo block, that would make sense. Out of curiosity, I rifled through Malone's kitchen drawers until I found a pencil, and then ran the lead of it back and forth over the impression in broad strokes. Slowly but surely, the numbers appeared. Oddly, it was the same number the neighbor had given us, except for the last number. Here, the number ended in a 9 instead of a 1. I stood in the middle of the living room, holding the piece of paper, frowning at it. On one hand, this was number 23's neighbor. It didn't matter what phone number he had last scribbled down. On the other, wasn't it strange that the last number he'd scribbled down had been so similar to the one number 23 had given him? Maybe someone else had asked him for it recently, and this was proof he'd given us the wrong number, off by 1 digit. I picked up my phone and unlocked the screen. But then I thought better of dialing the number from it. They'd be able to see mine then. I looked around the apartment, but it didn't look as if Malone had a landline. I even considered calling Harcourt Terrace station for a second, asking for Garda Cusack and telling her that I'd found the actual phone number for the tenant at number 23. But was that what this was? It could be a waste of time. She wasn't my biggest fan. No need to confirm for her that she was right the first time. Ultimately, I decided just to wait until I could tell Malone about it in person. I locked the balcony doors, then double-checked that the front door to the apartment was secure too. I'd seen a stack of old paperbacks in Malone's bedroom, including a couple of tech thrillers I thought might keep me mildly entertained. I figured I'd take a shower, climb into bed, and read until I could fall asleep. It was while I was in the shower in the ensuite that I first heard the noise. A muffled bang, like a cupboard door closing. I hit the button reflexively, stopping the flow of water, held my breath, listened. I couldn't hear anything except the beating of my own heart, which suddenly sounded thunderous. There was only silence, and somewhere beyond that, the very, very faint vibration of the washing machine. So nothing at all, really. But then, because I was straining so hard to hear something, the low-frequency thrum of the absence of sound. Something had probably just fallen over, or it could be coming from next door.
Or, you know, you might have just imagined the whole thing, because you've spent the weekend trying to find a serial killer and it's left you a little bit jumpy.
I turned the water back on, but my ability to relax had vanished. I just kept listening out for another sound. In the end, I gave up and got out. I'd been in there 5 minutes, maximum. Malone hadn't been expecting guests, and although the towel hanging over the shower door was dry, I wasn't 100% certain it was clean. I didn't want to go snooping, so I lightly dried myself with it and quickly put on what served as my pajamas. A ripped pair of yoga pants and an old t-shirt. Put back on my glasses. My hair was sopping wet at the ends, steadily dripping onto my shoulders. I put the towel back where it had been and went to check on my clothes in the machine. Another 5 minutes to go before the cycle would be complete. The note with the phone number was still on the kitchen counter. It was killing me not to try the one I'd revealed, but I didn't want to call it from my phone. I drummed my fingers on the countertop, thinking, what could you do with the phone number other than call it? I went back down the hall and into Malone's bedroom, picking up my phone off the bed. I pulled up the internet browser and copied the phone number into the search box. The top result was for a profile for someone called Brian Conway, BSc Honours, Property Management and Val, HDIP Management and Marketing, at R&P Estate Agents in Balls Bridge. I clicked on the link and the page loaded with a professional headshot of him, suited and smiling, next to a short bio, the phone number I just searched for, and an email address, hosted on the R&P website. What didn't make any sense was the man in the accompanying photo. It was the neighbor we'd spoken to earlier at Doolin Gardens. The man in the photo was the man who lived at number 24. I blinked at the screen for a full 5 seconds while the jigsaw pieces moved and slid and rotated. The number pressed into the memo pad was Brian Conway's number. Brian Conway was the man who lived at number 24. So when we'd asked him for the man at number 23's phone number, he'd given us his own, but with one digit wrong, the last one. The O'Rourkes in County Clare owned both houses, number 23 and number 24, but Conway complained about his neighbour driving down property prices. Why would he care when he must rent? Amy, you don't look like an Amy. And then suddenly, horrifically, everything clicked into place. And then I heard the noise again. A dull thud coming from the kitchen. Before I could dismiss it, rationalize it, minimize it, I heard something else. Footsteps. Tentative on a hardwood floor. Someone creeping, trying to be quiet. I held my breath, listening, and knew for absolute certain that elsewhere in this apartment, someone else was doing exactly the same thing. We'd driven from Doolin Garden straight here, stopping only to buy drive-through fast food for lunch. We'd sat in Malone's car outside the house for a couple of minutes before we'd driven away. We'd given Conway plenty of time to get into his own car and follow us here. The fear was immediate and all-encompassing and overpowering, and for one interminable moment, I thought it was going to totally overwhelm me and that I might just give in and pass out and die. You will die if you don't move. I felt rooted to the spot. Fear had glued me there. The bedroom was wide open. Locked doors. I had to put as many locked doors between me and him as I could. The bedroom and the bathroom were all I had. Footsteps in the kitchen. Coming this way. Clutching my phone, I tiptoed to the open bedroom door. Looking at the handle as I approached it, seeing, yes, a lock, and closed it as quickly and as quietly as I could, and then, shit, fumbling with the lock, my hands shaking, unable to turn it, the mechanism stiff or maybe even stuck. And here was the fear, pushing itself up again, coming now, and I heard myself make a noise, a kind of sound, the kind you might make if you just burned your hand off something hot. The footsteps, louder now, crossing the living room, almost here. Not caring about being quiet anymore. Underneath my fingers, the lock finally turned. I rushed into the bathroom, closing the door behind me. I didn't know why I was trying to be quiet. It wasn't rational. He knew I was here. I was shaking now, every limb trembling uncontrollably, afraid to breathe, my chest burning with the strain. I looked at the lock on the bathroom door, one of those locks where you turn a tiny switch in the middle of the handle, flimsy and easy to override. A kick would break it. I turned it anyway.
Allison?
The voice was muffled, his mouth right against the bedroom door, and me hearing it through two of them. But it was so calm and normal. It sent the fear climbing up my throat and a trickle of warmth running down my leg. I bit down on my lip, hard, tasting blood, in order to stop myself from screaming out.
It's just us, he said.
His tone was pleasant, friendly, upbeat. Why didn't you come out of there so we can talk? I unlocked my phone. The page for Brian Conway on R&P's website was still on the screen. Fingers shaking violently, I screenshot it and sent it to Malone with my third attempt at typing a word underneath it. Help! I couldn't get out of this. Not out of the apartment. We were a floor up. I could maybe get out of the bedroom window, but I couldn't think now what it looked like, and I didn't have enough time to waste some of it trying to figure out how to open it, or which bit of it I had the best chance of getting through. A sudden, loud bang against the bedroom door, quickly followed by another bang, and the sound of splintering wood. No, 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 no. Oh, God, no, please. A crash, something heavy and large clattering onto the floor. Footsteps now, striding across the bedroom floor. He was in. A ferocious bang against the bathroom door. I watched it shake, shudder everywhere except the point where the lock mechanism touched the frame. I began to feel strangely detached, resigned. Another bang of body against the door, and the lock would give way. I was trapped. I was alone. He was going to come in here and kill me. And there was nothing I could do about it. I thought, maybe this is what I deserve after sending away an innocent man. My heart thundered in my chest. And then I thought, fuck that. I scanned the bathroom. I was facing the door. Directly behind me was the sink with a mirrored medicine cabinet mounted above it. Could I break the mirror? Use a shard as a knife. To my right was the toilet. Would the top of the cistern come off? That would be heavy. I could try to knock him out. To my left was the bath, the electric shower mounted above it. The shower curtain was fixed to what looked like a plastered-in plastic rail. Useless. A bang as the whole door shook. I knew the next time. This is it, this is it, this is it. I threw myself behind the door just as he slammed into it again, and crack, the door swung open. Fast and hard, and in the mirror on the bathroom cabinet, I saw the blur of him entering the space, and as the door started to slam back on me, I put both hands up and pushed it back on him as hard as I could with everything I had. How dare you do this to me, to Will, to us? And just as he was turning around to look behind him, the door smacked into the side of his face, and recoiled, and I pushed it again, I pushed and I kicked. And now the skin just below his hairline was separating. A trickle of blood was filling the slice of dark space between the two pieces, and he put a hand to it, stunned, and he started to fall. And before his body touched the ground, I was already moving, pulling back the bathroom door, and then I ran, out of the toilet and out of the bedroom, to the front door. Get out, get out, get out! Neighbours, I'd seen lights out in other windows. There had to be some of them around here. I'd find someone. But the door to the apartment was locked, deadbolted from the inside, and as I fiddled with it, my fingers shaking, not obeying the instructions I was screaming at them from inside my head, I heard him, coming out of the bathroom, and footsteps approaching, running. Open the door, please, please, no! And then crack! Everything faded to black.
He doesn't have to be quiet, doesn't have to worry about being seen. There is no one here but him and her. A few lights shine in other blocks, yes, but he spent the last few hours sitting outside, watching this one, making sure they're alone. There were no lights on anywhere except the guard's apartment, the one with the balcony on which Allison had sat. But just to make sure, he pressed each of the block's 6 buzzers in turn. No response, not even from her. He was about to look for another way in when a man pushing a bicycle appeared in the lobby and opened the door from the other side. "Is there a McCarthy here, by any chance?" he asked. "I think I might be in the wrong place." The cyclist shook his head.
"There's only 2 of us in this one, and the other guy's name is Malone."
"Oh." He made a show of taking his phone out of his pocket.
"I better call them. I knew I'd get lost out here."
He held the door open for the cyclist, making sure not to close it all the way again. He was in. He'd never had it so easy. Isolated location, no internal cameras, not even streetlights outside. Even the door to the guard's apartment posed no problem, because he'd thought to bring his bunch of master keys from work. Different developers use different ones, but for developments like this, most made a choice for the same small collection. He practiced on a door down the hall first, an empty apartment where keys turning in locks wouldn't alert anyone. It was the 3rd key he tried. Silently, he let himself into the guard's apartment. He had no idea what waited for him on the other side, but just by opening the door a crack, he could see there was a hallway. That made it easier to slip in. Closing the door behind him, he heard the hiss of a shower running and smiled to himself. This was going to be even easier than he'd thought. He just wanted to talk to her. He thought it was time they had a chat, but of course she didn't want to listen. He wanted to tell her he wasn't like those other guys, that she didn't need to be afraid of him, that he was a nice guy. But she didn't even give him a chance to. She just assumed he was like the others. And that made him very, very mad. Now she's lying on the floor at his feet, unconscious, while a thin line of dark blood slides from her hairline and trickles down the side of her face, onto the guard's wooden floor. He looks down at her, shaking his head, annoyed at himself. Annoyed at her. She doesn't understand. That's the problem. Young girls today, they're so careless. They don't realize what kind of creeps are out there, what those monsters might do with all this information they're volunteering, posting out there in the world. He tried telling them, taking them aside and explaining it to them, but then they just mistook him for being one of those. So he decided to show them instead. Back then. Now, again. Because after he saw that documentary a few months back, he realized that his lessons from 10 years ago had long been forgotten. Things were worse than ever. These girls, they were practically sending these creeps illustrated maps to their own homes nowadays. So he had to show them what the consequences could be. And no one would pay attention unless those consequences were the worst imaginable. A few sacrifices to the cause would be worth it in the end. They'd thank him for it. He'd have saved them from the creeps, from the guys who might do a lot worse than him. His intentions were good. That's what they didn't understand. What he didn't understand was Allison going to prison to visit a convicted killer. And she isn't a young girl anymore, but a grown woman. She should know better now. He had to point that out. It didn't matter that her boyfriend hadn't done the things she thought he had. What mattered was that she thought he had, and she still went to see him in spite of it. He wonders if he should wait for her to wake up. They could talk then. He could explain that he didn't mean to hurt her, that he was only doing it so she wouldn't run away. But then he hears a phone ringing. He leaves her to find the source. The device is on the floor of the ensuite bathroom. Its screen is cracked, but he can still read what's on it. Malone. That's the name of the guard, isn't it? He lets it ring, waits it out, watches until the call gets kicked to voicemail, and then sees his own face appear on screen. What the? He picks the phone up to look closer, but the screen goes dim in his hand. When he presses a button, a keypad appears demanding a passcode. He throws the phone so hard across the room that it cracks the mirror above the sink clean into... She knows who he is. He should have been more careful earlier when they showed up at his door. But he was nervous and excited and confused, and he wasn't thinking straight. Now look what he's done, the mess he's made. Another one. She probably told the guard. That's why he was ringing just now. He can't stay here. They can't. If he can't talk to her, he'll have to teach her a lesson another way. And he knows now the stupid mistake he made with Amy. It all got too messy, too complex. The water is the only thing for it. He knows what he has to do. Decision made, he starts to feel calmer. There was a part of him that always knew the final sacrifice would be himself. But if he can't wake Allison up, she'll have to come with him. That's the only way this is going to work.
Allison, now. When I opened my eyes, I saw only an inky blackness. Panic rose in my throat as I thought for a second that the blow to my head had cost me my vision. I touched my face. My eyes were open. Then why was there no light? Why was there no difference? My head and neck throbbed, and something wet was around my neck, sticky and thick. Blood? Was I bleeding? I saw a tiny pinprick of light, a single dot, far off in the distance. While I watched, it turned red. And then I realized. It wasn't off in the distance at all. It was right there. It was a tail light. He'd put me in the trunk of his car. I was lying on my left side, curled up, with my left arm underneath my body. I tried to lift myself off it, to pull it out, but I couldn't move it. Was it broken? I could feel it, burning with pins and needles, but I couldn't move it. Why not? I tried my legs. They were fine. I wiggled my toes. All okay. With my free hand, I reached out and felt the furry, hard inside of the car boot. Touched the surface around me, above me. Nothing. There was nothing else in here with me, and I could find no handle or button to press. I'd no idea how long I'd been out. How far had we driven? Where were we? I couldn't hear any noise beyond the roar of the engine. The pain in my head was moving, growing, like something sharp unfolding itself, spreading its wings in the middle of my brain. White spots danced in my vision. My eyelids were growing heavy. It was exhausting to feel this much pain, and it was dark, and the surface my cheek was pressed against was furry. It felt nice. Maybe I should just close my eyes and go to sleep. It might be better that way. Minutes passed, or maybe hours. Then the car slowed. The noise of the engine dimmed, then fell away to a low hum. For the first time, I could hear sounds from outside, muffled voices. I rolled forward, wincing as a current of pain streaked up from my tailbone. Nausea gripped me and I tasted bile in my throat. But I was closer to the red of the taillight now. I pressed an ear against the trunk there, strained to listen. The car had stopped, but the engine was running. A woman's voice then. "Where are you headed tonight, sir?" His voice answered her, but I couldn't make out the words. "I'm afraid there's no access to the canal this evening, sir. Not past this point. It's due to a Garda operation. We have detours in place." She was a guard, I realized, and I knew what I had to do. I opened my mouth and screamed as loud as I possibly could, louder than I ever had in my life, screaming and screaming until I felt like I'd swallowed liquid fire and my lungs were threatening to burst. For good measure, I started kicking and hitting the underside of the lid of the trunk too. The engine roared to life and the car took off, at such speed that I was pushed forward, face first, into the hard side of the boot. A new wave of pain broke in my head. Then people were shouting. The car kept going, swerving from left to right, accelerating. There was a hard turn to the left. A sudden bang, a screech of metal. Silence. I felt my body lift, rise, heard a woman scream, and I knew. I knew what was happening. The Gardaí had him. They knew his name. They knew where he lived. They knew how he did it. and I was pretty sure he had just broken through one of their cordons at the canal, with me screaming in his boot. It was all over for him. That was good. He was going away now. But it was over for me too, because he was taking me with him. Impact. There was a thud, a splash, and then a rush of water against the car, engulfing it, sucking it down. The thoughts came calmly. I'm going to die now. This is how. Now is when. I should have stayed in Cork, and I should have stayed away from Will, and I should never have made that phone call, and I shouldn't have answered the door in Breda, and I should never have come back here. But it was too late to make good decisions now. A stream of water was trickling into the trunk by my feet. Which way was up, even? I didn't know anymore. I'm going to die now. After everything that had happened, it almost felt like a relief. I was so tired. So very tired. I closed my eyes. Water. Water is splashing on me, running over me, tickling my face. But I can breathe. I open my eyes, bring my free hand to my face. I can feel it. It's not underwater. I'm not underwater yet. Banging. A banging noise. More than one. Someone is banging on the trunk of the car, shouting at me. More voices. I want to go back to sleep. The water is cold. I close my eyes. I can't keep them open. A burst of light. It hurts my eyes. I shut them. Water going into my mouth. I cough. Hands. Around my arms and legs. It's freezing. I start to shiver violently. It's too bright. Something hard and cold. I'm lying on it and it hurts my back. Cement. They've put me on the ground. Lots of voices now. Someone is touching my hands, my wrist, opening my mouth. I feel like I'm going to be sick, so I turn my head and cough, and I can feel water coming up. I can hear it. I open my eyes. Bright discs of white light. What are those? She's breathing! What about him? Someone says. I turn my head the other way. Sea water, futuristic glass buildings, the river. No, the basin. I recognize it now. Grand Canal Dock, where the canal meets the river. I'm just a few feet from the edge of the quay, I think. Everything is blurry beyond 2 or 3 feet. I've lost my glasses. They've laid me out in one of those flat marble blocks that serve as benches. The black water is choppy, but I can't see anything in it. Blurry figures are standing at the edge, leaning over to look in. Some glance back at me. Someone is pulling off his soaking wet clothes, while another shrugs out of his jacket to give to him. Another pats the wet man on the back and says, "Fair play to you. Fair play." What about him? I turn my head the other way and there he is. Lying on the ground a few feet away, arms by his sides, palms up. His shoes are missing, not moving. Blood on the side of his head, from where I hit him with the door. His skin is wet and very white, almost waxy looking. Did I hit him with the door? That seems unlikely. Did I? A man stands near his feet. No, not a man. A boy. A teenager. His face is pinched in concern, but... not for Conway. For the woman leaning over him. Knelt on the ground by his side, pressing on his chest, dipping her head periodically to put an ear near his nose and mouth. "Mum," the boy says. "Is he?" She looks up at him and shakes her head solemnly. "No." In the distance, sirens. Alison, then. We hadn't been planning to go out that Sunday night. Will and I had gone to the cinema at Dundrum Town Centre early that afternoon, and only when we'd emerged, blinking, back into the sunlight, did Will see the text from his roommate. A bunch of them were at a pub in Portobello, the one by the canal. Claire and her boyfriend were there too. We could hop on the Lewis, be there in 15-20 minutes. He sent a text back saying we were on our way. "The curfew," I reminded him. Will said we wouldn't stay long. "We'll just go for a couple." But when we got to the pub, we discovered that a gang from St. John's had practically taken over this pub's beer garden. Everyone was there. It was also an unusually sunny spring evening, and 2 pints of cider in, I was warm and woozy, and not at all in the mood for going home. There was an atmosphere, and I liked it. Something between defiance and giddiness. We'd been there for maybe 2 or 3 hours when I felt the stab of a finger in the flesh of my back and looked up to find Liz staring down at me. I opened my mouth to say hi, but she was already moving on, searching for an empty seat around the table. She found one diagonally across from me, next to Claire. I watched as Claire greeted her and then as Liz leaned in and whispered something in the girl's ear. Claire's head lifted and she looked around and her eyes found mine. And narrowed. Will returned then. After he'd set 2 pints down in front of us, he turned and saw my face. What's going on?
Liz is here, I said.
He looked across the table and saw her. She was looking away now, deep in intense conversation with Claire.
Have you guys talked?
Not since. I shook my head. No.
Well, this is awkward.
Tell me about it.
Do you want to go?
Yes.
He nodded at the drinks.
Can we drink these first?
Can we drink them inside?
We stood up, collected ourselves, and turned to make our way through the throng back into the interior of the bar. Before we could, I felt the pinch of a hand on my arm, and Liz's voice, sharp and cold, behind me.
Where are you going?
I stopped to turn to her. And in that moment, someone pushed between Will and me, so I couldn't reach out and alert him to the fact that I was caught. He carried on, oblivious, carrying the drinks into the bar. I turned around.
We were just going inside, I said lightly. What's up?
I need to talk to you, Liz said.
About what?
A pause. About Will.
What about him?
Well... Liz looked around. This isn't really the place for this conversation.
Under normal circumstances, I might have said something like, let's go to the bathrooms then, or come outside to the front, we'll find a quiet spot. But I was so sick of Liz's amateur dramatics and hurt by her antics, and no doubt emboldened by alcohol, that instead I said, why bring it up then? She blinked in surprise.
What?
Why even bring it up if this, I made air quotes, I was on a roll now, isn't really the place to talk about it? But then, wait, do we even need to talk about it? Or can I guess what it is now? Let me see. I'm spending too much time with him, is that it? Or he's not your type, you don't like him, so you don't want to spend time with me if he's around? Or is this something to do with you running to the Gardaí to tell them your completely and utterly irrelevant information about that poor guy who made the mistake of, gasp, trying to talk to you at the traffic light ball, God forbid, leaving you so bloody traumatized that you had to sit in my boyfriend's lap and fucking kiss him? I shook my head. You just think I'm going to take it all, don't you? That you can behave however the fuck you want, however badly you want, however like a bloody toddler you want, and I'll just stick around. I'll take all your little digs and insults, your shit-stirring. Oh, you had lunch with Will in Dundrum, did you? Liz bit her lip.
I didn't say we had lunch.
That's exactly what you said, quote unquote.
Well, I didn't mean... You think I'll just sit there and smile while you make a face and say to friends of mine that my boyfriend isn't your type? What the hell was that supposed to mean?
I held up a hand. You know what? Don't bother. I don't care. I really don't. Not anymore. This isn't friendship, Liz. Newsflash. I don't know what this is. I don't honestly know what could be going through your head when you, like... I had to take a breath.
When you say those things, honestly, why would you insult someone who's supposed to be your friend?
My anger had fizzed out, but I wasn't done.
Seriously, Liz, what's going through your mind when you act that way? I'm actually asking. Because I don't get it. Why do you want to hurt me? I'm supposed to be your best friend. And I thought you were mine.
Hey. Will had appeared by my side. He looked from me to Liz to me again.
Everything okay here?
Liz looked away, Her lip was quivering. "It's nothing," I said to him. "Did you get us a table?" He nodded. "Yeah, just by the doors. I'll meet you there." He turned to go and I started after him, but Liz grabbed my arm and pulled me back.
"It's because I'm jealous, okay?"
she whispered in my ear. "Are you happy now? It's because I'm jealous. Because I like him too." I stopped dead, turned around to her slowly. "I'm really sorry," she rushed on. "It's not like I wanted this to happen. I don't know. I have feelings for him, more than just a crush. I'm sorry, Ali, but you must be able to understand that, of all people. Only imagine you can't be with him. Imagine someone else is, and you always have to see them right in front of your eyes all the...
Are you for real?"
Liz blanched. I didn't think for a second she was being serious. This was just more bullshit. Liz liking Will. Since when? How? Why? She'd never been alone with him. I wasn't sure they'd ever had a conversation I wasn't a part of. And she'd said it herself. He wasn't her type. No. No. This was more of it. More drama. More theatrics. She didn't like Will. She just didn't like me having someone like him. "I'm telling the truth," she said. "And I'm sorry." I put my hands on my hips to steady myself. I was definitely more drunk than tipsy now. "Let's say that's true," I said. "Pretend I believe you. Let's say, okay, that's why you've been such a temperamental bitch since I got together with him." I leaned in close until my breath was on her face. "What was your excuse for all the years before that?" Liz didn't respond. She dropped her eyes to the floor. "I'm leaving," I said. Before she had a chance to respond to that, I did. The next morning, I felt the regret before I even felt awake. In the cold light of day, I could see that I'd completely overreacted. Even if Liz was, for some reason, just out to cause drama by saying that she liked Will, there'd really been no need for me to say the things I had. Not all of them, anyway. And especially not the last thing I'd said. Now that I thought about it, I wasn't sure Liz had committed any worse crimes in our 15 years of friendship prior to St. John's that couldn't be classified as a bad mood. We all got into them. No one was sunshine and light all the time. And as for the last few months... Well, maybe she was telling the truth about Will, in which case she must have been really hurting. We should have waited until we were sober, then had a proper talk. We could have worked everything out. I groaned aloud. Damn you, Cider. While still in bed, I fumbled for my phone and typed out a text to her, saying we needed to talk. No response. I checked for one incessantly as I crossed campus to the arts building and kept my phone on vibrate during the meeting with my tutor, hoping I'd feel a buzzing against my thigh. None came. When she hadn't texted me back, by the time I'd started back towards Will's apartment, I tried calling her. No answer. It was late afternoon when the whisper started. "Another girl," they said, "in the canal." Then, at the end of the day, I came out of my last lecture and saw Will waiting for me, saw the look in his face. In that split second, I thought she'd called him and told him everything. "What's wrong?" I said when I reached him. "Did you talk to Liz?" He shook his head. He couldn't look at me. Then his arm was around my shoulders and he was steering me gently down the hall. There was a little breakout area there. Two sofas set at right angles to each other. I noticed that there were two men there too, in suits, and a guarda in a bright yellow flak jacket. I wondered what they were doing there. The men in suits didn't look like faculty, and they certainly weren't students. The guarda I connected vaguely with the curfew, increased campus security, although I'd never seen one of them inside. Will sat me down on one of the couches, sat down himself too, and took both of my hands in his. "I'm really sorry," he started. His voice sounded like he was being strangled. I had no idea what was happening. "It's Liz," he said.
I'm so sorry, Ali.
What about her? Did you guys talk?
Will shook his head, and when he looked up at me, I realized with a shock that he was crying now, streaks of wet tears running down his face. And I started to cry too, even though I didn't yet know what was happening. I was just crying over the fact that he was. An instinctual response, a reflex.
What is it?
I squeezed his hands.
What's wrong?
It's Liz, he said again.
And that time I got it. All the pieces fell into place, and I thought of what she'd said about that creepy guy following her, and how I dismissed her. And then I thought of the pub the night before, what I'd said to her, the horrible, horrible things, the unforgivable things now, because there was no one to forgive me, no one to listen while I tried to take the words back, and I felt like I was suffocating, choking. The guilt was a solid block pressing down on my chest. I made a sound like I was in physical pain. I fell forward, into Will's arms. I don't really remember much of what happened after that.
Liz died on the Sunday night, or technically in the early hours of Monday morning. I got the news on Monday evening. My parents arrived on Tuesday, checking into a hotel nearby. I didn't want to go home with them, didn't want to leave Will, who they'd met now, suddenly and unceremoniously, and I'd been asked by the Gardaí not to leave campus permanently until they had interviewed me. The funeral was to be in Cork at the end of the week. I was obviously going home for it. What I didn't know at the time was that I wouldn't be coming back. I felt broken, exhausted, empty. Numb, but also not numb enough. I couldn't sleep, but I didn't want to be awake. Mostly I just sat curled up on the couch in my apartment, wrapped in a blanket, or in Will's arms, or nestled against my mother, or in a merciful, drug-induced sleep in my bed. Faceless figures moved around me. They offered me things. Food, sympathy, advice. I paid them no attention. I couldn't even talk to Will. I'd never said anything to him about what Liz had said to me in the pub, and now there was no way I could. All I wanted was to bury my face in his chest and stay there until the rest of the world went away. Liz's parents arrived on campus soon after mine. I'd never seen such pain on a person's face. They looked like they'd aged 10 years overnight. It struck me then. Whatever she was to me, she'd been a daughter to them. A sister to her brother Ben, somewhere in the skies between here and Sydney. A granddaughter, a niece, a cousin. I'd only ever really thought of Liz in relation to me, as the person she was around me, to me. I couldn't face any of her relatives now. Not just because of what I'd said to Liz, but because this feeling now, this pain, wasn't pure grief. It was shame, too. Regret, guilt, embarrassment. It was about me. My pain was egocentric, thinking about myself first and foremost, even now. Which only made me feel more of those things. At some point during that awful week, Will and I, and some other freshmen we knew, had to go to the provost's office to be interviewed by the Garda detectives in charge of the Canal Killer case, as the tabloids were now calling it. My mother had forced me to shower, but I hadn't bothered to dry my hair, and I was dressed in loose grey things, a sweatshirt, leggings. I didn't care what I looked like. I just wanted to take one of the magic pills and go back to sleep as soon as I possibly could. Will went in first. I waited outside in a hard plastic chair with my mother by my side. It was in the evening. No staff were around. The hallway and the other offices off it were completely quiet. Because of that, I could hear everything that was being said inside.
You saw Liz on Sunday night, I believe.
Me? Very briefly. At O'Shea's in Harcourt Street. But Alison talked to her for a bit. I only said hi, I think.
But then not again?
No.
Do you know what they talked about?
No, but
what?
I think one or both of them might have been upset about something.
You don't know what?
I don't know the details, no.
You and Alison returned to Hall's?
Yes, we were back by 11:30, I think.
Liz called you, though, at one point.
I didn't realise she had until one of, Garda Collins, I think, was it? He asked me to check my phone. It showed a call from Liz at around 3 in the morning. But I didn't talk to her. I was asleep.
But the call was answered. It is possible Alison talked to her.
I mean, it's possible, but she would have said, surely.
How do you explain it, then?
I think I probably just reached out to switch it off, to stop the ringing so it wouldn't wake up Alison, and I must have pressed accept instead.
Alison was there all night?
Yeah, she stayed over. After about 10 minutes of this, it was my turn. There were 2 men in suits, detectives, and a female Garda in uniform waiting for me in the room. When they saw me, their faces softened. A student welfare officer was sitting in the corner, managing to look both fascinated and concerned. I dropped into the chair they pointed to and fixed my eyes on a spot on the floor.
"We'll keep this brief,"
one of the detectives, Shaw, said.
"I'm sorry for your loss, Alison, but we're doing everything we can to get who did this. I know this is hard, but if you could just confirm a few things for us."
They didn't so much as ask me questions as they asked me to confirm everything Will had said. Had I seen Liz on Sunday night, early on, at the pub?
Yes.
Had I talked to her?
Yes.
Did she seem upset?
I don't know.
Other people said she looked upset.
Do you know what about?
She said someone was following her. She said she'd talk to you guys about it.
You didn't see her again?
No.
You stayed with Will that night?
Yes.
Do you remember his phone ringing?
No.
Well, if you think of anything.
Okay. I went straight back to my room, back into bed. Will got into it with me, held me. Neither of us spoke, each lost in our thoughts. I swallowed another pill and waited for the darkness to descend. When I woke up the next morning, the room was filled with bright sunlight. The curtains and halls were a joke, practically transparent. Will wasn't there, and the space in the bed beside me was cold. My head felt like it was filled with a fog, the aftermath of the sleeping pill, of 3 or 4 consecutive nights of taking it. I rolled over, squinted in the sun, and my eyes landed on the calendar tacked to the wall above my